Following on from what we did last time, we're going to do some interviews in full, this time from Athens. First, I must apologise for my voice. I've got a terrible cold, so I do apologise for that. But without too much further ado, I'll get on with our first interview. And that was done with Dr. Notke from the City Hospital in Birmingham. And he had looked at asthma and using adenosine with asthma. Now, on the prescribing information, it's one of the contraindications. But we all know, anecdotally, that adenosine has been used with asthma relatively safely. But it took a bit of courage to actually put this in a presentation at Athens, and so I'll lead you on to that now. I've got Dr. Notke here from Birmingham City Hospital, and he's just done a great paper on adenosine stressing with asthmatics. Dr. Notke, would you like to tell us a little bit more about the paper you presented?
Basically, one of the problems we had is the amount of the pressure we have on the cardiac service. So we have been always leaning towards using adenosine because it's more efficient to use from the point of view of patient throughput, as well as I think it's safer for the technologist. However, the problems with bronchoconstriction and asthmatics, which is quite a large proportion of our patients, about, I mentioned in the paper, 10 to 20% of referrals, means that that group has to go through either physical distress or through dobutamine, which both lengthen the procedure, needs more medical supervision for the stressing, and basically it makes it more difficult to do. So what we looked at is trying to use slightly modified protocol with adenosine, which will hopefully make it as safe for the asthmatics as non-asthmatics. And the changes basically are we prime them first with a bronchodilator like salbutamol, two puffs is what we use. We wait for a minute or two for it to work, and then the other thing we noticed was that the symptoms are severest when we suddenly start the infusion of adenosine. And so we thought if we gradually increase it from half the dose calculated for the patient to the full dose within the minute, they seem to get much less side effects, including shortness of breath. So we also started with half dose, made it to the full dose within a minute, minute and a half. However, the rest of the test, which is a total of 6 minutes infusion with the radiopharmaceutical in the midpoint of 3 minutes, we kept exactly the same. And then in this paper, we basically did 20 consecutive asthmatics, which had good history of asthma, would normally be done with dobutamine, had even hospital admissions within the year, most of them for asthma, using this priming with salbutamol followed by slow increased infusion. And basically we noted less side effects and no severe bronchoconstriction in any of these patients, which we didn't have really to change any of these into dobutamine so far. And since then, we've actually, this paper, the abstract was written early on, but now we've completed 50, at least 50, and we still don't have anyone which we had to stop the test. The other safety is, of course, if they get bronchoconstriction, you stop it, they usually revert within a few minutes. So I feel it's not safe enough to do this until we are convinced that there's no problem with this, really.
So the patients actually who were non-asthmatic had a greater incidence of asthmatic symptoms, didn't they?
Just about all the symptoms, actually, were more severe. And we think, I mean, that's the technologist, the lead technologist we have. He said that he thinks that it's because we gradually introduced the adenosine in the asthmatics. So he said if it's okay to do the same for the non-asthmatics, which we said the end effect is the same, so why not? And he says patients are much more comfortable with it. So We haven't officially looked at gradual increase, but however, that's become part of the standard protocol for all the patients we are using now. So that may be a reason for it. Salbutamol, of course, could be the other reason which prevents the bronchoconstriction, I think.
Anecdotally, this is something that I've known lots of places to do, but no one's ever presented it before. I think perhaps they're worried that if something did happen, they might get into trouble. I think it'd be great if you could publish the paper.
Well, yes, I mean, the numbers I presented here, 20 versus 20, that's 42 altogether, I think wasn't sufficient for us to be sure about it. We've now done a total of 100 or over now, and I think once we've sort of analysed them, hopefully the same conclusion. I mean, I know that none of them had to be abandoned, so it can be used, I know. But however, we'll look in detail and then present and hopefully publish it, yeah.
The alternative, the traditional alternative in asthmatics is giving dobutamine, but dobutamine has some unpleasant and unhelpful side effects as well. So could you, this may actually prove to be the safest way to do stressing.
Well, I feel so. I mean, I think so. As adenosine doesn't rely on causing ischemic sort of a episode in the heart for diagnosis, so it should, in theory, be safer. And the great thing about adenosine is it's very quickly reversible, more than anything else I know, actually. Half-life of 10, 11 seconds. And side effects subside within 2 minutes, which even if a patient gets the chest pain, is much less likely to be a permanent sort of a effect than a transient one. So it, I feel it's much safer, and that's why I think, we have, going through the procedures, of course, we have decided that it's safe enough not to have a medical presence for adenosine. I'm not quite so sure about dobutamine. Maybe more training is required for it, which makes it more expensive, of course, as well.
There's some practical time issues involved. Dobutamine takes a long time to wear off. So,
That was one of the big reasons we moved to adenosine. We book for a dobutamine 3 quarters of an hour per patient. So in an afternoon, we can do maybe in an hour, basically, one patient and a bit. While with adenosine, allowing for problems, we book every 20 minutes. So it's almost more than doubling the number of patients for the stressing session, which means the stressing session finishes earlier and it releases the technologist to do the imaging.
Have you had any patients with quite severe asthma that you've used this protocol for?
We have used it in all the asthmatic patients, those with even oral steroids on, who had admissions within the year. We haven't actually omitted anyone so far. If the patient comes short of breath, sort of responding to his normal medications, I would be reluctant to use it until they're settled in. But once they're settled, I think, we haven't had that, but maybe we could use it. But however, we'll monitor it and be very careful with that.
Anecdotally, I've certainly seen severe asthmatic patients being given adenosine where dobutamine's been contraindicated, where they've got a left bundle branch block, and even patients that are having asthma prevention, you know, 8 times a day, I've seen this used under medical supervision and without any problems, from my personal experience.
Adenosine, the way people give it sometimes varies from place to place. So I wouldn't say that nobody will ever have any problems. But however, if it's used cautiously and sort of knowingly that sort of a variation in the protocol may cause problems, I think it is fairly safe. I mean, we've used it since 8 months now. We've been using it on all the asthmatics. Hopefully we won't run into a severe problem. But as I said, however, uncontrolled asthma, I think I would be avoiding, of course. Maybe we should avoid any stressing until he's settled and is sort of back to his normal level.
Yes. Do you think this has any implications on the new selective adenosine, so on their success? I mean, can we get away with using traditional adenosine?
Well, it'll be cheaper. That is one thing. I mean, the other thing is just selecting patients using different things makes organization more difficult. I mean, if you don't have to choose one from the other, etc., it's much easier because often the patient turns up, you don't know they're asthmatics, and you just, he says, I'm not asthmatic, but he produces his Ventolin, breathing in before the test, and then you start worrying it. But however, if you can get away with an agent which doesn't cause asthmatic attacks, like the protocol we have introduced, hopefully, then you don't have this worry at omitting the patient, or rather cancelling the test and arranging for another day. The way we had it is all the asthmatics were booked in a different session, so it was treated completely differently.
Right.
That can cause its own logistic problems as well, which hopefully will be avoided.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate your time and giving up to talk to the Nuclear Medicine and Molecular Medicine podcast. I appreciate your efforts, and it's a great paper, and it's something that's long, long overdue, I'm sure. And I'm sure it was it's controversial, but perhaps it shouldn't be. Thanks. That was great, and I'd like to thank Dr. Nodke for helping us out with that podcast. There was another paper too presented at the conference from the Brompton Hospital in London as well, that dealt with a similar issue. So I think this is changing, and I think adenosine really is going to be the way that really a lot of stressing is done, with very few exceptions. But quite an interesting paper, and it'd be nice to see that that published as well down the track. Now the next speaker I have is Martha Pickett, and Martha Pickett's been a long time stalwart of nuclear medicine training in the USA. She runs a course in Arkansas, and has been presented on iLearning and internet learning and distance learning. She's also been an editor of the Journal of Nuclear Medicine Technology. But one of the things that she's really been looking at is training in more advanced ways for nuclear medicine technologists. And really, a little bit like nursing has advanced nursing practitioners, she's thinking that we should also formalise perhaps something that's been happening for quite a while, and look at advanced practitioners in nuclear medicine. And so I think this is an important topic, and I think it also points to where things are going to be happening in the future. Here we are back at Athens again, and we've got Martha Pickett, who does a wide variety of educational things, from the Journal of Nuclear Medicine Technology to running courses. But I'm going to talk to her today about the super technologist. So, and anybody from the US in particular will know Martha. She's quite famous. So I'm just going to hand you over to Martha, and she can tell us a little bit about the concept of the super technologist.
Okay. First of all, I'm going to change the word that we use, super technologist. We're not going to use that word anymore. The official word that has been approved by the Society of Nuclear Medicine is nuclear medicine practitioner. So NMP is what you'll hear us use. We really want to get away from the technologist component and go toward the little bit more advanced practice component. But basically what we see in the nuclear medicine practitioner is that this will be someone who is educated at the master's level. They will take on tasks and responsibilities that would be similar to a PA or nurse practitioner in nuclear medicine. closer to a PA, I think, and we'll have a very close relationship with their physician. And we're in the process right now of developing the curriculum for the schools that will develop, that will offer the programs. Obviously, since it's master's programs, they'll all be at university settings. We get a lot of questions at our program about what people, when people think about, well, what do I need to do to get prepared to do this? This is something I've been wanting to do for a long time. Because it is a master's degree, I would suggest to anybody who's interested in this kind of a career path would be you at least need to have your bachelor's degree out of the way. If you don't have one, you should go get one and start working on that. And in general, I think probably the university you would go to would probably require a GRE and so forth. But basically, and I think we're going to most likely recommend some experience, probably at least 2 years. Some schools may want 3, 4, or 5. But we're looking at our university when we get ready to do this. We'll be looking at people that have considerable amount of experience. In terms of what technologists have told us is that one of the things they really like about this career track is this allows them to move up in their career without leaving the clinical setting. And I think there's a lot of very, very, very good technologists out there that just, they don't want to go into management, they don't want to go into education or radiation safety or the usual sorts of things, and they're not that interested perhaps in industry, but they really excel in the workplace and working with patients on a day-to-day basis. And many of them are already doing the kinds of tasks that we expect they'll be formally trained to do as an NMP.
That sounds great. I mean, already there has been a move here in the UK for nuclear medicine practitioners, a little bit like nurse practitioners do, who do a lot of work in the UK. In fact, in the UK, nurse practitioners will be the only medical professional to actually see a patient and diagnose and prescribe treatments and diagnostic tests. So I guess at the moment in the UK, we run courses for technologists to do stress leading of cardiac stressing, but we also run courses. There's also places where they do reporting. Are those the types of things we'd see a nuclear medicine practitioner do?
Yes. When we looked at the competencies, which will be published in the JNMT probably in the spring, and they're also on the website, we looked at 5 areas. We looked at general nuclear medicine, things they would do there, but we looked at special competencies in cardiology and stress testing. When we did our surveys, we had a physician surveys, we had a lot of interest from cardiologists on this. We will expect a special competency in PET and probably fusion imaging types of things. We will, and I imagine that as therapy develops, that may be a whole new specialty, because that's where the science is going these days. It's just amazing what's going on there. And we will we'll have a category of for administrative work. I guess there's 4 areas, and then the fifth area would really just be a specialty area. It would be certain kinds of things that not every NMP would have to learn to do, but might learn to do based on what the physician wants them to do, such as conscious sedation or lumbar punctures and so forth.
Oh, thank you, Martha. That's a great introduction. Is there somewhere that people can go to get a bit more information about this career path?
The Society of Nuclear Medicine, with the technologist section, has posted the white paper that outlines the general concept on the website, and it is going for publication in the JNMT, the next issue out, which I think will be December. And that will be a lot more detail about the background behind how this was developed. And also on the website is a list of competencies in much more significant detail than what we've talked about here. They are on the SNM website, and they will be published in the next JNMT. This year, the task force is working on a detailed listing for the curriculum for schools, and when that's ready to go, that will go on the website, and then will also be published in the JNMT as well. It's our goal to have that ready for and approved by the midwinter meeting of the SNM, which is in February of 2007. But that will provide, I think, a good resource for anyone who wants to know kind of what the lay of the land is. There are no schools that are offering it yet because they don't really have the resources and tools to do that, but they're working on it. I know that we're looking at doing this at UAMS in Little Rock, and there's another school, it's Boston. Well, it's in Boston. I can't think of the name of it. It's in Boston. It's where Dave Gilmore and Francis Keach work. Those are the only two schools that are looking at it right now. But I'm sure there will be others that will offer programs in the future.
Thanks, Martha. I was just wondering what your impressions of the conference at Athens were, and what have been your highlights so far.
Well, I've only been here for one day, so the conference is always is very interesting. It's different from the ones I go to with the SNM. I really like the international flavor, the different viewpoints, different things that we see and hear. I find it very fascinating that how much we are alike as compared to how different we really are. But it's the differences, I think, that give the flavor to life and to nuclear medicine. I think my favorite thing always is I do get to see friends that I only see when I come to the EANM, and I enjoy that very much. As far as Athens goes, I mean, what can you say? It's a fabulous city. And I think the people that live here, the Greeks, they're very friendly. It's very laid back, and I like how safe it is here, and certainly, you know, around where the convention is and where our hotel is. It's just been a very, very pleasant experience.
Well, thank you very much, Martha. I really appreciate giving up your time for the Nuclear Medicine Podcast, and I really appreciate you helping us out. Thank you.
Well, that's all we have for today. Thank you very much for listening to the Nuclear Medicine and Molecular Medicine Podcast. Hopefully I'll be back in better voice and have more things to say next time, where you can listen to the rest of the talks that were given at Athens and the interviews that we managed to get. And I do appreciate the interviewees that we spoke to in this podcast. If you want to get this podcast, please tell your friends. Go to nukecast.com or to Molecast, that's molecular medicine, so molecast.com, or go to iTunes if you've got iTunes on your computer, and simply type in Nuclear Medicine and it will come up with the podcast. And if you feel like putting a review in there about the podcast, please do. So thank you very much for listening. Tell your friends. I'll catch up with you next time. And if you're interested in the music, this time I've got some music from Magnatunes, they provide music for podcasts. Although I did buy this because I thought it was good music. They do have a whole variety of music, and Magnatunes have a lot of music that's available for podcasting licenses. So thank you again. If you come back, if this is the first time you've listened to the podcast, go to nukecast.com, have a look at some of the old podcasts we've done, have a listen to them. But more importantly than all of that, please send me an email, drop me a message. In the last podcast, in the show notes, you'll see details on how you can get in touch, how you can leave some material by phone or via the internet, or just email us at nukemedpodcast@gmail.com. So please keep in touch. We'd love to hear from you. We'd love to hear your feedback. Bouquets and brickbats are just fine, and we'll catch up with you next time. Thanks again.